This is the story of a stove.
An energy-saving stove made in Uganda.
When Child Fund worked with local youth to make and sell these stoves, well, things really heated up.
Because these stoves use very little wood and produce less smoke.
Reducing deforestation and respiratory disease.
They're creating jobs and a brighter future.
This is only one of Child Fund's many innovative solutions benefiting children in need worldwide.
To learn more, visit childfund.org.
Child Fund. Innovative solutions, one child at a time.
Criminal justice studies are concerned with the preservation of peace, the prevention of crime, and the protection of life and property. A knowledge of the role of criminal justice in our society also serves to emphasize the importance of balancing the needs of society to maintain social order against the need to safeguard individual rights. For more information on the HFCC Associate Degree Program in Criminal Justice, contact the Criminal Justice Department at one of the following numbers: 313-845-6437, 313-845-9714, or 313-845-9859.
Hi, this is Go Mike Holloway reminding all of you loyal listeners to tune in to the Go With The Flow Mike Holloway Show every Tuesday afternoon, 4 to 6 p.m., right here on WHFR.FM, the station that is always making waves.
The views and opinions expressed by the following program do not necessarily reflect those views by Henry Ford Community College or WHFR Dearborn.
Hi, this is Steve Levitt.
And this is Stephen Dubner. We want to thank you for downloading the Freakonomics Radio podcast.
Why are we thanking them? The podcast is free, right? Shouldn't they be thanking us?
This is public radio, Levitt. It's just the way things are done here.
I don't know. It seems strange.
Come on. Just say it. Say it.
Thank you.
From the bottom of our hearts, we thank you. There's a lot more Freakonomics at Freakonomics.com.
Glenn Beck. I'm an entrepreneur. I am a reluctant, believe it or not, commentator and dad.
All right, now to the theme of our conversation today. When I say media bias, you say what?
Yes.
From WNYC and APM, American Public Media, this is Freakonomics Radio. Today, how biased is your media? And how do we know? Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
Let's say that Glenn Beck is right, that the news media is biased, whatever exactly that means. Now, before you start foaming at the mouth, because I know that's what you're going to do, let me just say that you'll also hear from someone on the other side of the aisle, someone who sees things very differently.
I don't know where to begin in describing how completely ridiculous I think that is. I mean,
pick a spot and begin. That's Andrew Rosenthal.
I'm the editorial page editor of the New York Times, which means I'm in charge of the editorials.
We'll hear more from Rosenthal later, but first, let's get back to the assertion that media bias is real and that it's a real problem. How do you prove that? How do you measure something like media bias rather than just opine or bloviate about it? Here's Steve Levitt. He's my Freakonomics friend and co-author.
So measuring media bias is a really difficult endeavor because unlike what economists usually study, which are, you know, numbers and quantities, media bias is all expressed in words. And so in the last 5 or 10 years, there have been some really tremendous advances in how we think about text as data. So how we take words and transform words into quantitative measures. And at the forefront of this endeavor have been people like Jeff Milo and Tim Grossclose and my colleagues, Jesse Shapiro and Matt Jenskow. And so take the Grossclose and Milo work, for instance. What they did was they wanted to figure out how to compare media sources like the Wall Street Journal or the New York Times or Fox News, how liberal or conservative those outlets were compared to, say, politicians.
So there were 20 media outlets that I examined. Also, the original article had a co-author, Jeff Milo.
That's Tim Grossclose.
I'm a professor of political science and economics at UCLA.
Grossclose wanted to see if he could answer questions like, how does the average article in the New York Times, with its supposedly liberal slant, compare to the average speech by a Democratic heavyweight like Harry Reid? And similarly, how does coverage on Fox News with its supposedly conservative slant compare to the average speech by someone like Michelle Bachmann? To make comparisons like this, Grossclose had to start with what he knew, with what was easy to quantify, that is, the political leanings of politicians themselves. So, to that end, he assigned each Congress member a score, which he called their political quotient, or PQ.
And this is just a way to say precisely how liberal someone is. So 100 is very liberal. It's about a Nancy Pelosi, zeros Michelle Bachmann. These are all based on roll call votes in Congress. And in fact, I let the Americans for Democratic Action pick the roll call votes for me. This is a liberal interest group. And with each roll call vote, the ADA decides whether the yay or the nay alternative is liberal.
Now, if you were listening carefully, you heard Grossclose say that he, quote, let the liberal ADA set the standard for each congressperson's political quotient, or PQ, which might make you wonder about Grossclose's own PQ. So, before moving forward, let's back up a bit. As part of this research project, Grossclose wrote a quiz that anyone can take to assess his or her own PQ.
My hunch is that if you and Steve Levitt took my PQ, my best guess is you would turn out to be kind of left-leaning moderates.
Yeah, Levitt put himself at about a 45.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
I would have predicted 55 or 60.
But he didn't actually take your test. I think he guesstimated. And I probably put myself at – and again, I haven't taken it either yet. I'd probably put myself at about 55 or 60. You're probably right on there. So together, we're right down the middle.
And I say my political quotient is a 13, which means I'm very much on the conservative end. Not quite Michelle Bachmann, but kind of near John Boehner, Mitch McConnell.
Give us some well-known politicians and what their PQs are, keeping in mind that 100 would be pure liberal and zero would be pure conservative, right?
Right. So, yeah. So like Nancy Pelosi, Barney Frank would be about 100. Barack Obama is not the most liberal on this scale. Barack Obama is about an 88. Hillary Clinton was something like a 87.9. They were almost exactly tied on this scale. Joe Biden would be something like an 85, 84. Harry Reid, 80. Joe Lieberman was a 74. Now, I computed two PQs for Joe Lieberman, one when he was a Democrat, one when he was an independent. They're almost exactly the same. I think when he was a Democrat, it was like 74.7, as an independent, a 74. So he moved just the teeny, teeniest bit right after he switched from Democrat to independent.
Okay. So Grossclose had given each politician a PQ, or political quotient, with 100 representing a hardcore liberal and 0 a hardcore conservative. Now, to make the connection between the politician's leanings and the leanings of media outlets, he needed to take an intermediate step. Now, this will be a little confusing at first, but bear with me. The intermediate step was to take more than 150 think tanks and interest groups and assign each of them a political quotient.
The Center for American Progress.
The Heritage Foundation.
The Brookings Institution.
So now, having determined a political quotient for each of these think tanks, Grossclose could start to measure media bias. How? Well, he simply counted how many times the name of each of these think tanks and interest groups were cited in the 20 major media outlets he was studying. So let's say that a given newspaper cited a group like the liberal Citizens for Tax Justice much more often than it cited the conservative Americans for Tax Reform. That would drive up that newspaper's liberal score on what Grossclose called a slant quotient. He used the same scale for the slant quotient as he used for the political quotient, which is that 100 is the most liberal and 0 the most conservative.
The New York Times got about a 74. Of the 20, 18 of the 20 leaned left. Now, just about none of them were to the left of the average Democratic speech. So, some of my conservative friends, I said, the New York Times sounds about like a Joe Lieberman speech. Conservative friends said, that's it? That's not very liberal. In some ways, NPR was something like a 67, so even to the right of a Joe Lieberman speech. So in some ways, my results, I think, say that the media are in some ways more centrist than lots of people have been saying. On the other side, I analyzed one Fox News show. This was Special Report. When I analyzed it, Britt Hume was the anchor. That slant quotient was a 40, which means it was 10 points right of center. And so it sounded about like a Olympia Snow, Susan Collins speech.
So Grossclose's argument, based on his research, is that most news organizations empirically lean to the left, although not as dramatically as some critics might suspect. He ultimately wrote up his findings in a book called Left Turn: How Liberal Media Bias Distorts the American Mind. Now, how did he come to that conclusion, that the American mind is being distorted by media bias? Well, Grossclose combined his own findings and existing research to calculate that the average American voter has a natural PQ, or political quotient, of around 25 to 30, which is firmly in the conservative range. But, as Grossclose sees it, the left-leaning media pulls some of those naturally conservative voters into the center, which is why we generally vote about 50-50. Without media bias, Grossclose says, we'd be a much different country.
So I suggest that we would be about like Texas or about like Kentucky. It might be even more conservative.
If Tim Grossclose is right, and it's a big if for sure, I wanted to know this. How does that bias happen in a newsroom? Does journalism simply attract more liberals than conservatives? And think of all the choices a given writer, editor, producer will make in a given day. Which story to cover and which to not. Which sources to cite and which to leave out. Which conclusions to draw and which to leave to the reader.
Well, it's not about the culture of the newsrooms per se, because all sorts of people work in there, although I would say that the NPR newsroom tends to be much more like a liberal college fraternity type of environment.
That's Juan Williams. He's a political analyst for Fox News. He used to work for NPR and Fox News at the same time. You may remember that in October of 2010, NPR fired Williams for some comments he made on the O'Reilly factor about Muslims.
But when I get on a plane, I got to tell you, if I see people who are in Muslim garb and I think, they're identifying themselves first and foremost as Muslims, I get worried. I get nervous.
He was not expecting to get fired.
I was in shock. I don't think I knew what to do. I went and ate some Chinese food. I did another TV show before I spoke to anybody about it. And that tells you how crazy I was. It's kind of lost in my mind over this thing.
Naturally, Williams became a poster boy for media bias, which was strange, or at least seems strange to me, because he has one of the most nuanced views on media bias that you're likely to find.
Well, the process, it can be amorphous, but here's the thing. It's a creative process. And I remember once sitting at a lunch with Katharine Graham, former publisher of The Washington Post, and we were talking about newspapers, and I don't know why, but I said to her, 10 years ago, this would be a totally different newspaper. You know, I have a different group of people, different opinions, different strengths, different interests. And everybody at the table said, well, of course. And I think the idea that this is not a programmed, constant feed of news happening out there, and the newspaper or the news program is a direct reflection of that news. To the contrary, it's a reflection of the people and the agendas of people in the room as they begin to tell their story. For example, I find that as baby boomers have moved through American society, the political society, the cultural society, the economic society, that they have, in essence, told their story and told it loudly. They are a dominant voice. So their interest, their point of fascination, in fact, their self-reverence, has dominated news coverage for the last three decades.
It's an interesting point Williams makes. Putting together a news report is inherently a creative process, and it'll reflect the people who do it to some degree. But is it really their decision? What about the owners and managers of these media properties?
How is it that media firms choose their content, basically? Or how is it they choose to have conservative slant or liberal slant?
That's Matthew Jensko. He's an economist at the University of Chicago. Along with a colleague named Jesse Shapiro, Jensko set out to ask this question. If newspapers are slanted, does the slant really come from the newsroom or maybe the corner office?
We wanted to know, is that really an economic decision that looks like any other firm choosing what flavor of ice cream to offer or, you know, what kind of shoes to sell? Or is it something different? Are those decisions driven by the personal tastes of the owners of media outlets or their political agendas?
So Jensko and Shapiro wrote a computer program that would sort through millions of articles from hundreds of newspapers. The program's job was to identify politically partisan phrases.
And then, of course, the crux of the matter is, how do you define what's a liberal phrase and what's a conservative phrase? And our idea, which builds on some work that Tim Grossclose and Jeff Milo had done earlier, was to look at the speech of politicians, look at speeches by congresspeople. The nice thing about congresspeople is we know which ones are liberal and we know which ones are conservative. That's easy to measure. So we could ask, what are the phrases that liberals or Democrats tend to say a lot relative to conservatives, and what are the phrases that conservatives tend to say a lot relative to liberals?
So they fed the entire text of the 2005 Congressional Record, which is a transcript of every congressional proceeding and debate, into their computer program. And what did it spit out?
I'll have to remember with this table whether we whether you should read down or across to get the top 10. I'll read the top 10 down. So the top 10 phrases used more often by Democrats are private accounts.
Private accounts inside.
Private accounts.
Private account, whatever.
Trade agreement. American people.
The American people
are speaking out.
The American people.
Tax breaks.
Trade deficit.
Oil companies.
The oil companies.
Credit card.
Why the credit card companies would like to do it.
Nuclear option. War in Iraq.
The war in Iraq.
And middle class.
While leaving middle class families out of the cold.
The two word phrases on the other side used more often by Republicans are stem cell research,
affordable natural gas.
It gets pretty cold in Omaha.
Death tax.
I'd vote for it.
Illegal aliens
into the United States.
Class action
reform is badly needed.
War on terror.
You're winning the war on terror.
In the war on terror.
Embryonic stem.
I am 100% opposed.
To embryonic stem cell research for research purposes.
Tax relief. Illegal immigration.
Do something about illegal immigration.
And date the time.
What was that last one?
Morning hour be deemed expired. The journal of proceedings be approved to date. The time for the two leaders be reserved.
So, I really like the phrase date the time because it reminds people that this is an automated method that involve no judgment on our part and that these things are just spit out by the computer.
Republicans had the congressional majority in 2005, and it's the majority that uses this kind of procedural language more often. That's why date the time makes the list. Other frequent Republican phrases?
Change hearts and minds.
Border security.
And, believe it or not,
Grand Ole Opry.
2005 was the 80th anniversary of the Grand Ole Opry. Some common Democratic phrases?
The Arctic Refuge.
Living in poverty.
And
Rosa Parks.
This was shortly after Rosa Parks' death. So having categorized all this language along Democratic and Republican lines, Jensko and Shapiro looked at how often a given newspaper used each of these signature phrases. And from that, they were able to determine each newspaper's political slant. But it was the next step that really mattered, figuring out where a slant comes from. In other words, is it that reporters have a bias that gets into their stories? Or maybe newspaper owners demand a certain line of coverage? They looked into these factors and more, including one very clever indicator, the voting patterns of the people who read a particular newspaper. Their finding? The most important factor driving the slant of a given newspaper is the political leanings of the people who buy it. In other words, newspapers are giving the people the news that they want.
Yeah, I think the broad conclusion of our paper is that newspapers look just about like every other firm in the economy. What the people making the decisions in the newspapers are doing is trying to sell newspapers. And it may be that the reporters have their own personal political views. It may be that the owners have their own personal political views. It may be that everybody involved would love to push their own personal political views a little bit more. But something we show in this paper is that if they did that, it would be really, really costly. They would lose a lot of money. And I think at the end of the day, most of the time in most places, the people in control are not willing to give up lots and lots of money in order to change the content of their newspapers to satisfy their own personal views.
Coming up, we ask Ann Coulter what she'd do if the New York Times came to her for help.
I would dance a jig.
And we go inside the Times to talk to the editor who gets this kind of email.
Thank you for making me laugh this morning. Another blithering idiot at the New York Times. Why don't you put on a tight skirt and just be a cheerleader for Obama?
Freakonomics Radio explores the hidden side of everything. Sponsoring the Freakonomics podcast could help nearly a million listeners a week discover your business. Email us at sponsorship@wnyc.org.
From WNYC and APM, American Public Media, this is Freakonomics Radio. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
So, early we heard from Tim Grossclose, a UCLA professor, who says that the U.S. media is categorically, empirically biased to the left. Now, if you think that's true, what do you do about it? Here's his idea.
I would say maybe hire more conservatives.
You know Ann Coulter, the commentator and author? She's on Grossclose's side. I understand that Tim Grossclose has this quiz on his website. You test your political quotient. You can kind of align yourself, match yourself to various politicians. Did you take that test? How'd you do on it?
Well, I would say I got an A-plus as a conservative.
So let me ask you this, Ann. If, let's say, Jill Abramson, editor of the New York Times, comes to you and says, you know what, I think you're right. I think all these years you've been right and that we want to do
better. I would dance a jig.
but let's say that she were to come to you and say, Ann, we think you've been right and we've been wrong, and we are starting over. We have a great infrastructure here. We know how to report the news, but we want to render the news more down the middle. What are the top priorities that you would give, let's say, the New York Times?
Hire 10 conservatives.
It's as simple as that. It's just find a different set of people.
I mean, just having a conservative around, it breaks the cocoon effect, I would imagine. A conservative working at the Times would be able to tell them, David Brooks isn't a conservative. Could we have someone else representing us? And I think that's all it would take. Maybe there is invidious bias and they just secretly hate us or openly hate us. But I really think it's mostly a matter of not knowing any conservatives.
Coulter very much agrees with Tim Grossclose that a biased media pushes the American electorate further to the left than what it would naturally believe.
I don't know where to begin in describing how completely ridiculous I think that is. I mean,
pick a spot and begin.
That's Andrew Rosenthal.
I'm the editorial page editor of the New York Times, which means I'm in charge of the editorials, letters to the editor, the columnists who work for the New York Times, and the op-ed stuff, which is people who don't work for the New York Times who we invite to write their opinions, and that's in the paper and online.
So here's the thing. I used to work here, as you know, and when you work here, even if you're a fan of newspapers and journalism, which some people are but not so many, you understand that there is a demarcation. There is a Maginot line between – or maybe a DMZ is a better phrase, between what you run, which is called Opinion here, and the news shop. So can you describe how it works here?
Sure. Well, the purpose of it, quite simply, is to keep the expressed opinions of people who are journalists who express their opinions out of the news columns. It is to avoid the contamination of news with opinion. Not the other way around, obviously, because there is lots of news and opinion writing. So, and that is to maintain the independence of the news report. The Times was historically one of the first independent newspapers. And by independent, I mean politically independent. Before the current publisher's family bought it in 18, whatever it was, the New York Times was a Republican newspaper, which people will find hilarious. The first editor of the Times actually was Abraham Lincoln's campaign manager for re-election and one of the founders of the Republican Party. It is vitally important to remember in this context that the Republican Party of Abraham Lincoln had nothing whatever to do with the Republican Party of John Boehner.
And was there much of a distinction between editorial and news at the time?
No. In fact, the editor of the newspaper ran the editorial page and the news
But there
pages.
Was there was an editorial page, but it just wasn't
Correct. It was run by the same person who ran the news pages.
Gotcha.
And that was a common thing. And it's not entirely uncommon right now. I know people who are editorial page editors who report to the chief news executive of the organization that they're part of. And I think that that's the problem. And that's what we deal with here, is that at the New York Times, the most important thing is the news report, just overwhelmingly. It's our reason for existence. And that is run by Jill Abramson. Jill can't tell me what to editorialize about. Doesn't know what I'm editorializing about, doesn't know what positions I'm taking, although a lot of the positions we take aren't big shockers if you've ever read the New York Times editorial page. And I don't give her advice on what news to cover, and neither one of us has any involvement in the other's personnel decisions. I don't go to their news meetings.
Yeah.
The people from the newsroom never come to editorial board meetings. We meet three times a week, the editorial board and the editorial writers. The people from the newsroom never attend those meetings. And they are not invited to be part of it. I view it as wildly inappropriate when people tell me what I should write on the editorial page, and it sometimes happens, and they all get the same response, which is, you know, my dear friend, or if they are my friend, or my colleague, please don't ever ask me a question like this again. You know how this works. And then they stop immediately. Everybody here knows what the deal is. And they don't lobby for positions, and I don't lobby for coverage.
Let me ask you this. So here's some official language from, I guess, the Times website. The editorial department of the paper is completely separate from the news operations.
Yes.
And Mr. Rosenthal, it's you, answers directly to the publisher, Arthur Sulzberger Jr. I'm just curious, do you ever wonder if that's a kind of, you know, quaint, old-fashioned demarcation that has maybe outlived its time? In other words, that it's impossible now, the way that news travels, the way that news is consumed, for the reading public not to conflate the opinion report of a paper like yours with the news report?
I think it's very hard for them not to. For people who grow up, for example, in Europe, it's almost impossible because they don't really have – well, they do, but there's a lot of European newspapers that are where they commingle. And there is something that has happened. You know, everything we've been talking about is about institutional separation and bureaucratic separation and about separating the stuff that my people write from the stuff that Jill's people write.
Right.
This does not guarantee the separation of opinion from news. And what's happened over the last decade or so to a great extent, a constantly increasing extent, and a lot of this is because of what's going on online. And we can talk about that if
right.
you like. But is the seepage of opinion into news, not from the editorial department into news, but within the news departments of media.
Right.
People, they are doing opinion.
Including your own paper.
Yes.
So let me ask you this. Does it drive you crazy some days when you read the news report of your own paper, which is as good a news report as there is, and say, hey, that should be on my page, not on their page? Do you see phrases? Do you see ideas?
No, it's more like, you know, and I think this is important, and this when this comes to media bias. I think that by and large, the news articles in the newspaper are very straightforward. They have no stake in the outcome, that the writer does not believe that one way or another should be the way that the thing turned
right.
out. Certainly you do not have a situation where people are either twisting facts or leaving facts out to make something appear different than it really is in order to suit their ideology. I think the language is pretty straightforward. I think there's more analysis in New York Times articles than in most – that used to be. Now everyone does it. What you see is actual –
the implication being that analysis tends to hew a little closer to opinion than straight news.
It hews closer to conclusion. You know, I mean, if you've ever been a foreign correspondent like I was, and I was a foreign editor for a while, foreign correspondents need to do reporting that reaches a conclusion.
Right.
A foreign correspondent in Afghanistan who is not telling you which side is winning the war is not doing his job, and that's a conclusion. And it's not that – I want this side to win the war. And also, a little bit in political reporting, you have to reach conclusions about how candidates are doing. And if a candidate's losing an election, you have to say so.
There is a kind of, I think, common analog. I hope I'm not overstating it by saying that it's common, that Fox News is to the right what the New York Times is to the left. I'm guessing that you would see that as a false equivalency on a lot of levels. Tell me if I'm right.
I think it's – there's a word I want to use here, but even
please.
On public radio.
We bleep so much on
well,
the show.
It begins with bull and ends in it, and you can figure out what comes in between. I think it's absolute pernicious nonsense. I think that there – you know, I've been at this newspaper a long time. I've been in a lot of newspapers. Fox News presents the news in a way that is deliberately skewed to promote political causes, and the New York Times simply does not. We make mistakes. We don't achieve perfect balance. There is no such thing as perfect balance because there is such a thing as truth.
Talk about you for a minute growing up with New York Times Inc. kind of in your bloodstream. So your dad was the editor of this paper for nearly 20 years, I believe, which were very important years for this newspaper in a lot of ways.
They were formative years.
Talk for a minute, though, about – okay, so you are the man who runs the most important opinion section in newspapers. And you are the son of the man who ran the news report here for nearly 20 years. So just talk a minute about that household and what position the New York Times played in the orbit of that household.
Well, it's the other way around. It was the household in the orbit of the New York Times.
Okay.
You know, I mean, the New York Times – my dad was, you know, man of his generation. He was born in 1922. For him, the New York Times was the beginning and the middle and the end of his existence, and he was dedicated to it entirely. He believed, you know, you know what it says on his gravestone, right? He kept the paper straight. I have a thing on my desk, which most people don't know what it is, but it's that reverse lead type.
Uh-huh.
And he hired a reporter from the Philadelphia Inquirer, discovered after he hired her that she'd been sleeping with one of her sources at the Philadelphia Inquirer, and fired her, even though it had nothing to do with the New York Times.
Wow.
And someone said to him, why do you care who she sleeps with? And he said rather memorably, and it's there on my, I don't care if you f*** an elephant just so long as you don't cover the circus. And that was my dad. I really truly believed that you could do that to an elephant and he'd be okay with it. But, you know, no circus coverage. And, you know, and that – but that is the – no, seriously. I mean, it sounds goofy.
No, but that's the core
But it's profound. It's the core of journalistic principle. And by the way, journalistic principle applies to what I do too. We don't lie. And we don't work for Barack Obama, or we're not members of anybody's team. It's journalism. We're supposed to be writing our opinions about stuff as we truly see it. A great editorial is a strong position, firmly held, quickly and cleanly expressed, based on actual reporting.
You know what I learned today? I learned that media bias is probably an argument that'll never go away. We put out a podcast not long ago about how people choose to believe what we believe, about everything from the risk of global warming to whether we've ever been visited by UFOs. Now, it turns out that a lot of us unknowingly bend our beliefs to fit our political or social or family circles. We carry around all sorts of personal biases that we simply don't see. The best description I've ever heard of this comes from Danny Kahneman, the Nobel-winning psychologist and author of Thinking Fast and Slow. He calls it being blind to our blindness.
Well, there's a lot of psychological research that points in that general direction. We think other people are biased, and we don't feel that we are biased. We feel that our opinions are right because our intuitions tend to land on one coherent interpretation of the world, and that looks almost like a sure thing. And so we tend to be overconfident in whatever we believe. That's generally true. And, you know, we find it much easier to find the errors in other people.
So we'll continue to point fingers at the other side while declaring ourselves blameless. That seems to be the nature of the human beast. But more troubling, at least to me, is that we seem to like it like that. One reason we love to argue about something like media bias is that after all these millennia, we still thrive on tribalism. We still love to divide ourselves into us and them, left and right, liberal and conservative, whatever you want to call it. We find the tribe where we fit in and we rush over to join and rally around its flag and immediately start tossing grenades at the idiots who are flying the other flag. Now, personally, I find this instinct a little bizarre, this instinct to herd ourselves into one of two major groups. Why should we want to define ourselves as right or left? If I'm a hardcore environmentalist, that means I have to want higher taxes too? If I'm pro-death penalty, I can't also be pro-choice? We love to complain about partisanship in Washington and in the media, but could it be that we get the partisanship we want, the partisanship we deserve? Here's my advice. If you want an enemy to root against, watch more sports. That's what sport is good for. It's a proxy for war, for violence, for tribalism. And then, when the game's over, when you're ready for some nuance, come back to the real world. And only then, if you think you're calm enough to handle it, pick up a newspaper.
Freakonomics Radio is produced by WNYC, APM, American Public Media, and Dubner Productions. This episode was produced by Susie Lechtenberg with help from Jacob Berman. Our staff includes Catherine Wells, Diana Wynn, Bure Lamb, and Chris Bannon. David Herman is our engineer. Jacob Bastian is our intern. And our executive producer is Colin Campbell. If you want more Freakonomics Radio, subscribe to our free podcast on iTunes and go to Freakonomics.com, where you'll find lots of radio, a blog, the books, and more.
Hey, this is Derek, and listen to Skepticality for Tuesday, January 31st, 2012.
Science! Science! Swoopy, Derek, Chris Solnadell here from Melbourne, Australia. Just sitting in the car, just finished listening to your Neil deGrasse Tyson interview. Wanted to say what a fabulous interview it was, and was hadn't fully appreciated what a giant this Neil Tyson guy actually is. We don't get him out here, I don't think. Anyway, I was particularly impressed with the sort of clarity of responses to your questions, and in particular his three-tiered answer to your question about, you know, what would he do to get people to look up. Clearly, the guy's quite an amazing communicator. So thanks for your work, and thanks for interviewing him. And, yeah, I'm looking forward to many more shows. Been listening for a long time now. Keep up the excellent work. Really appreciate it. Bye now.
Welcome back to another episode of Skepticality, the show that brings you news and interviews with scientists, skeptics, and critical thinkers from all around the world for the promotion of science! So, yeah, back to just little me once again. And I hope you all enjoyed getting to hear from Swoopy last episode, but she liked being back. So, don't worry, she'll be stopping in from time to time. Just this episode, we both got really busy, so she couldn't make it. Also, that little message you heard just before me, that was one of the voicemail messages we get. If you want to be featured, send us a voicemail at about anything from our episodes or just about things that are happening in your neck of the woods that happen to be science-based or skeptical. Just send us a voicemail toll-free at 1-866-800-2121. That's 1-866-800-2121. So we had a winner for the t-shirt giveaway last episode. The winner was able to get his entry in within 40 minutes, which probably means he stopped the episode to send the email and then listen to the rest of it, we hope. Keep that in mind, because this time we have another giveaway, and it's a signed copy of the fantastic graphic novel Dr. Debunco. It's by Chris Wisnia. You can hear our interview with Chris back on episode 35 of our show. A link to that episode will be in the show notes. To win a signed copy of Dr. Debunco, all you need to do is to be one of the first to send in an email to hosts@skepticality.com and tell us what the name of Chris Wisnia's graphic novel company is and what it means. The first three people who send in the correct answer will get a signed copy of the book. So this week we have an interview with Daniel Bolini. Daniel is an Italian writer, martial artist, and university professor. His newest book, 50 Things You're Not Supposed to Know, Religion, is part of the series of books being put out by the Disinformation Company, who happen to be the same folks behind the popular disinformation website at disinfo.com. Disinfo.com is a website which is all about news and information that you didn't know you needed to know. So, Daniel, have you here? You have a new book that came out.
Yep.
Now, before we get into your book, you are a university professor, a writer, and a martial artist.
Yeah, and, the usual mix, right?
Yeah, well, the last one I found fun. You are involved with MMA?
Yeah. I've done, well, I mean, recently not so much, but I've done a couple of pro fights. I've done a bunch of smokers, which are kind of the unsanctioned amateur fights. So, yeah.
You also wrote a book about the philosophy of martial arts.
Yeah.
How did your interest in martial arts came before or after your being a professor and writer? Which one came first?
No, it's kind of funny. I mean, I started martial arts when I was a teenager, and I was sort of the opposite of what everybody does, in the sense that typically people get into it out of, you know, machismo, testosterone, and then they mellow out and they see sort of the deeper aspects of it. Mm-hmm. I started out having this old, very romanticized philosophical image of martial arts. It's all about Zen this, Zen that, the beauty of movement, the deeper philosophy. And as time went by, I started feeling like, you know what? That philosophy is great and all, but let's shut up and wrestle now. Let's, you know, let's just fight and be done with it. So it's kind of the opposite of what it's supposed to happen, but it was fun, you know. So I started out with a lot of Chinese martial arts first, and then eventually I switched more to combat sports, doing more jiu-jitsu, boxing, wrestling, that kind of thing, which obviously then is for MMA.
Now, were you doing that MMA stuff before it became a big deal on TV?
Let me think. Kind of, yeah. I mean, I've been watching it pretty much from the get-go. I think I started watching UFC 2 or 3 or something. And then I was still doing martial arts, but I kind of the switch to training in a more MMA type of style. Probably 2002, something like that, somewhere on there.
So all this happened before you became a professor, philosopher, writer?
Let's see, I started teaching in 2001. So roughly around, well, the MMA part roughly around the same time. The martial arts, no, I've been doing before. But MMA, yeah, was somewhere around the same general area. And writing was, I mean, it's kind of funny because my dad has written a million books and my mom wrote books and she's a journalist. So writing was kind of something I grew up with just because it's kind of what everybody did around the house. So I started writing fairly young. I published a book in Italy when I was 22 and then kind of went on from there. My English still sucks, so I couldn't quite pull it off in US. It took me a while to be able to adapt, and then you know, my speaking voice has a thick crazy accent, but my written one doesn't, so eventually now I can write in English all right, just as much as I can do in Italian.
Oh yeah, I mean, you still have that thick accent, but you've been here in America for what, 19-20 years?
Yep, 20 years.
Unless you're on TV or radio most of the time, most people don't have a reason to get rid of an accent anyway.
And plus, women like it, so screw it. I'm not getting rid of it.
Well, you see, I was wondering if that was the reason.
That's the only reason why I do anything, ever.
Well, you're Italian.
Exactly.
So, we can get in your book, and your book is religion.
Uh-huh.
The things that, well, describe your book.
It's basically Disinformation, the publishing company. They have a series that was called 50 Things You're Not Supposed to Know. They did a few books with that type, but it's basically part of a series, you know. Then they decided, initially was sort of a general 50 Things, then they started tailoring it to different specific arguments. And they asked me to do one on religion that they wanted to do. And so it was fun because I could come up with just any 50 things, people, events, anything that was strange, bizarre, preferably offensive, you know, anything that was in some way or another, either not maybe part of something that's well known, but maybe the details of something were not so well known, or just some stories that are way out there that people may not be familiar when they think of organized religion.
Well, yeah, a lot of that is very true. When I was reading the book, I noticed that you really highlighted on the things that people revere, but yet they don't really, they've never really read the Bible to actually follow through with the rest of it.
Of course.
It's like the fun part, like when Moses comes down on the mountain, off the mountain, things are happy, but then what happens after that?
Yeah, I know. If somebody was to ask, you know, if you were to ask somebody a question and say, who's the guy in history who masterminded the murder of some 3,000 people because of his own, you know, 3,000 civilians, by the way, because of his own religious ideology, you know, Osama bin Laden would have come to mind. But nope, right there. Well, I mean, of course, yeah, you have bin Laden, but also right smack out of the Bible, Moses is behind the exact same story, where he comes down from the mountain, finds that some Jewish people are not so sold on his version of monotheism, gets royally pissed over the fact that these guys are worshipping different gods, and as his loyalists grab their swords and hack them to pieces.
Such a nice little guy.
Yep, lovely.
Right after he just came off the top of a mountain where he told everybody you shouldn't kill people.
Yeah, but then of course, if you're not honoring the God that tells you that you shouldn't be killing people, then of course you should kill these people.
Yeah, and you also, in this book, mention a fun blueprint on how to start your own cult.
Yeah, I had fun with that one. It's, I forget, I think the title, chapter title is How to Get Money and Sex from Your Followers by Starting Your Own Cult. And I was having a little fun because obviously most cults tend to follow the same patterns. And from the outlandish claim to the weird names for the founders to the, you know, all the step-by-step that you need to do. So, yeah, if you are into this, is create your own cult 101, how to do it.
Yeah, I thought that was very funny because it's something that most of the time doesn't get published in a way.
Right.
Yeah, yeah, and one of the most, I guess I could say, offensive to many people would be some of the truth behind the weird cohort between Christians and Israel.
Right. Yeah, it's interesting because, I mean, most Christian fundamentalists have hated Jews forever. And so there have been, you know, persecution of Jewish people in every Christian country since the beginning. And yet now you find the people who are the biggest friends of Israel tend to be Christian fundamentalists. And it's like, why? You know, did these guys change their mind all of a sudden? And it's not really about changing their mind. There's like this weird interpretation of the Book of Revelations in the Bible that that basically suggests that Jesus will come back only when A, you need to have a state of Israel, B, the state of Israel need to rebuild the temple, C, Israel enemies need to attack and try to destroy the state of Israel, and at that point Jesus will come back. So the whole idea of the support for the state of Israel is we need them there so they can get attacked so that Jesus will come back.
So before the 40s, when we didn't have Israel in where it is now, when was Israel there to begin with?
Right. I mean, that's why they wanted them. They wanted Jewish people back, that they wanted eventually to for them to get back to Israel, to start a state, to do the whole thing. Otherwise, the prophecy couldn't come true, or at least the way they interpret the prophecy, because the Book of Revelation is a mess. I mean, it's extremely hard to interpret in any which way. But the way it, around the turn of the century, late 1800s, early 1900s, it got to be interpreted, was that you needed the state of Israel occupied by Jews and them rebuilding the temple and then being attacked.
Funny part is, I think a lot of people don't see it that way anymore.
Right.
But as you put in the book, that's kind of how they started. Now, do you think that most fundamental Christians now even think about it that way?
No, I mean, I don't think the word think and Christian fundamentalists go together very often, but no, probably not. Well, depends who you ask. I'm sure some people still have strong anti-Jewish feelings, and so their support for Israel is based on this idea that we need them and all of that stuff. But I'm sure also things change, so I'm sure some of them mellowed out, and they are not quite as anti-Jewish as they were in the past.
And now they just sympathize with him because of the terrorism issue.
Right, which is kind of funny too, because I mean, Christianity and Judaism, they actually, all Western religions, they are all spin-off of the same thing, essentially. You know, they all start from this Abrahamic tradition, and it's just the way they interpret it, the way, you know, every one of them tell that they heard God's voice and that God's word is contained in their books. But then each one gets a different message, and so that's why they argue with each other.
Yeah, and you mentioned that wasn't until recently when we had traditions in Western religion that are things like our traditions and values, they all spurred from a different thing altogether that wasn't Christianity.
Yeah, I mean, of course, all the religions, nothing is born out of nothing. So Christianity, even Judaism was born in an environment where there were a bunch of different religions being practiced. So in turn, they influenced them as well. Zoroastrianism played a huge role, a bunch of things, a bunch of different traditions. The whole cult of Mithra, which was originally a Persian god, has enormous similarities with the whole Jesus story. There are, you know, inevitably, if you grow up in a certain area and certain religious traditions are practiced there, they will influence the birth of whatever new religion comes up in the area.
You have a whole chapter of the book just about that, all the different religions that have the same stories that are in the Bible that came long before the Bible.
There's definitely, I mean, and that is a short, tiny little chapter. They can have, you can write books on this stuff because there's so much material on this.
And you also get into respected things like Zen.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's funny I read that part of the book. It's like, you know, I remember reading that at some point. I forgot it too, that where Zen came from.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, Zen is basically the meet. Originally, it starts out as the meeting between Buddhism being imported from India into China, Taoism already being there, and the two of them mixing together. So Buddhism is kind of Zen is sort of a Taoist version of Buddhism, or a Buddhist version of Taoism, however you want to call it. But basically, that's the mix right there.
And then the quote-unquote peaceful part about Zen is kind of funny when you think about why it came to be.
Yeah, I mean, the Buddhism is by definition, you know, one of the big principles of Buddhism is about non-injury, so how you are not supposed to be hurting, not even just other human beings, but even animals and so on. So it's funny that it starts as this very peace-loving religion, and in many places it may still be, but then it becomes very popular with the samurai class, and the samurai are professional killers, you know, they make a living by killing people. So it's sort of bizarre how you can edit certain aspects of religions that may be not quite fitting with your day-to-day life, but because you're attracted by others. So in this case, the samurai were attracted by the Zen quality of being in the moment, having no attachment, which ultimately leads to being unafraid of death and not being... if you can live without attachment, you can go into battle and not worry about whether you're going to come out alive or not, because you're just focusing on the moment. And that gives you a huge advantage on the battlefield, because you don't freeze up with fear. That was one of the big appeals of Zen for the samurai. The fact that then they had all this peace-loving stuff. It's like, yeah, yeah, there's them there too, but we sweep off to the side, because it's, you know, we got people to kill, so.
Sounds like nothing has changed.
No, I mean, people, one of the beautiful things about religion, and not just religion, but everything else, is that people, really people make up their own religions as they go, more than they follow. When people say they follow a religion, nobody follow jack shit. People edit messages to suit their own lives. And I have nothing against it. I think it's great. I think everybody should do that. Just don't lie about it. You know, just don't tell me that... you are following something when obviously, inevitably, everybody does a cut and paste and focus on some aspects and ignore others.
I remind people that all the time about that. It's like, you know, if you want to use the Bible as a reference and say that gay people shouldn't exist or anything like that, well, then if I have to believe you and you believe that, then I have to believe that you believe everything else that's in the book, which means if you read it, you have to be a little on the odd side.
Oh, totally.
Like, no. I mean, the Bible's pretty strict about you shouldn't ever have tattoos. Having right. Jesus on a cross in a building yep. is yep. idol yep. worship, and that's especially forbidden. All these things are actually more often cited in the Bible than the one passage about being gay. And that's and that's not even like clear if that's what they're saying or not.
And that's one of the things about the beauty of the for Christians about the Old Testament is that anytime the Old Testament say what you want to say, then great. It's the word of God, it's the truth, we want it. Anytime the Old Testament say something that seems a little tasteless today, then you can just say, well, that's the Old Testament, we don't really follow that anymore, we go by the New Testament. Which is awesome because you really can... You can use it if you want to, and you can ignore it if you don't, and it gives you the perfect excuse.
I wish that, you know, my computer programming language were like that. I could do so much better.
Yeah, seriously.
You get the idea that your goal here is to try to make people think about religion, make it yep. enjoyable, mm-hmm. and something you should discuss with others, even if you expect there to be a difference of opinion, which I think that happens all of the time. So this book's really... about
testing 1, 2, 3.
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess it's to me, getting into religious discussion doesn't have to be a fight, because ultimately there really is nobody that just by the label they carry, whatever religion they belong
check,
to
check.
I'm going
there.
To
I got the mics down, but okay,
to such and such religion, because ultimately everybody is different. The very same religion, there are basically 30,000 different denominations.
WHFR, Dearborn. We will now hear a live special broadcast from Dearborn City Hall, hosted by Jay Cornick and Dennis Reimers of the Monday, of the new WHFR Journal Talk Show.
Thank you, Lisa. This is Jay, and Dennis is here, too. Dennis has got his headphones off right now. We're at Dearborn City Hall at Schaefer Road and Michigan Avenue. All of the big-name politicos and administrators of Dearborn,
both
city and school district, are here. And in the background, there is also a small, I think it's a four-piece group from the Dearborn Youth Symphony who are playing. And that's trying to keep everybody calm, I think, while it's happening. Dennis and I both, so we're going to stay with this special programming, and we do thank Lisa for allowing us to cut into her fantastic jazz music show on this Monday. This was sort of a last-minute thing, and we're making it happen, it looks like, at least so far. Mayor hasn't started speaking yet. Some of the people around here, I am just... 3 or 4 feet away from Gary Warrenchuk. He's meeting and greeting people and, of course, trying to let them see that he's a wonderful person not having any ethical problems of his own, of course. We see a lot of the members of the Dearborn City Council. I remember big, tall Ted Tefelsky has walked down the aisle here.
Tim Tefelsky? Yes.
You're sure?
I'm going to stick with that, yes. You know, we're in the back of the, it's like an auditorium. It's a wonderful chamber here for the city council. We're in the back, and everybody had to go by us. And, in fact, Dr. Mee squeezed by and said hello before she took her seat. So, yeah, there's quite a few people.
President of Henry Ford Community College, Dennis Mee, right? And let's see here. Well, it looks like it's going to be a capacity crowd. We're trying to estimate how many people can actually.